Michael Bugt offered me a tape reclaimer's job at Capitol. With age, I think I've learnt a lot. It's a good thing. And I can't tell you that I didn't go home and cry.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Rob Jones.
I grew up in Liverpool, born and raised in Liverpool, went to Liverpool College, and at school I was in all the school plays and everything, so being a show-off, I suppose, was part of the deal. And early years, very sporty. I was in the rugby team, I was captain of hockey, played hockey for Lancashire and Wales, under 21 level. Lots of friends in Liverpool. Sadly, lost touch with many of them these days. That's so sad. But when I went off in my career direction, they all went off and did sensible jobs. And never the twain shall meet in some ways, you know. So I'm only in touch with a couple of people. My father died when I was 8, very young. And had he not died, I wouldn't have come into this business at all. I would have been a sausage and pork pie maker, because he had a sausage factory called Jones's Famous Sausages, and I would certainly have gone into the family sausage business, which was actually then sold to Ross Frozen Foods, father of Francis Rossi of Status Quo. Those two companies merged just before my dad died, and then the die was cast. I wasn't going to be a sausage maker. I like music. But not. I realise now I wasn't as passionate about music as some people I've met over the years in radio are. I like the idea of radio more than the music. The music was just the means. It's the bits that filled in between you on the radio, which is very self-centred and egotistical, isn't it? But that's the truth of the matter.
It's 3:15. Time for Listen with Mother.
Well, it's got to go right back to Listen with Mother. I mean, quite seriously, Listen with Mother.
Are you sitting quite comfortably? Then I'll begin.
I remember that tune in the afternoon. So Mum had the radio on all the time. I even remember the actual radio itself. I can remember it was white with a red dial. So that was the absolute earliest memory of radio. And then later on, at school, very lucky, one of our masters at school had worked for the BBC and started a broadcast option. So in spare hours and after school, you could learn how to do a radio show or actually even do a television show. And he had a cottage in the grounds of the school, built a studio there, and that was fantastic. And he said one day, would you like to go and see this programme called Pick of the Pops? Because he knew Alan Freeman quite well. And I thought, that'd be good. So I went down to Broadcasting House with Ian and stood there, and watched Fluff do Pick of the Pops. And it was just, wow, that's what I want to do.
That's the second change they've made. That's a sensational single in Pick of the Pops today. It's going to be a smash. The Holly's there with He Ain't Heavy. He's My Brother. Hello, Mum.
I remember the faders, well, actually, there were pots. I remember Fluff taking all his jewellery off and putting it meticulously on the side there. And what a big personality he was, and how loud it was in the studio. I was in the sort of control room, actually, looking in. I wasn't actually in the room. Just watching him cue up a record. I'd never seen anyone cue up a record before then. And lots of hand signals and flamboyance. It was exciting. My careers master at school talked me out of being an actor, because that was the other thing I wanted to do. Said, no, go and be a chartered accountant or a salesman. And immediately after school, I didn't want to go to university. I had a place actually at Leeds to do geography, but decided that I wanted to follow this chartered accountancy route. So worked for as an article clerk for a company called Panel Fitzpatrick in Liverpool. And I'd been there 2 weeks when they said, oh, actually, the rules have changed with the chartered accountancy organisation now, and you have to go to university. Or in my case, it was going to be Polytechnic for a year to do your foundation course. So we've got you a place at Liverpool Polytechnic, now called John Moores University, but it's a Polytechnic. And I did the foundation course, and it was it was fine, you know, I passed it, got my foundation course, and the next thing was you do your part ones.
Thank you, Bruce Windham.
Love Noel on Radio 1. Yeah, I'd love to say I was listening to lots of Radio 3, and Radio 2 wasn't on your your frame at that time, for me anyway, at sort of 19. And I did have Radio 4 on occasionally, but not a lot. So it was Radio 1 mostly, because I could pick up Piccadilly a bit. Oh, and earlier than that, I was able to get the Pirates. We used to go on holiday to Anglesey in North Wales, and you could pick up Radio Caroline North on Anglesey. This was 65, 66. I remember hearing the Beach Boys coming off this pirate radio. Then I heard R&I. I remember listening to R&I, Radio North International, and Roger Day was the one name I could remember from that.
This is a test transmission from Radio North Sea International. 5.6 metres in the medium wave band. And no matter where you're listening, well, I'm in the country. I don't mean in what room, you know. I mean, don't say you're listening in the kitchen and writing like that, but just say what country and what town and what time you're listening.
I'd not long gone back into the accountancy firm at the end of that year when I decided with my friend, whose dad helped me with all the equipment and everything, that we'd make a demo tape, or I'd make a demo tape and send it off to lots of radio stations, because there were these new commercial radio stations opening up at the time, none of which I'd actually heard. And I did send the tape to Radio Merseyside. I sent it to John Russell, was it, at BRMB, Colin Walters, Piccadilly, Michael Burke to Capital, and a few others too. And the first one to tell me sorry was Radio Merseyside. Then BRMB said, no, thank you very much. And then I suddenly got three interviews. One with Colin over at Piccadilly, one with Michael Bucht in London, and one with a lady called Gillian Reynolds at Radio City. And Colin offered me a job. They all three offered me a job. Colin offered me midday show, 1 till 3 on Piccadilly. God knows why. I had no experience whatsoever, but the salary was £1,400 a year. Michael Bucht offered me a tape reclaimer's job at Capital. Can't remember, I don't know if we ever got round to the salary. And then Gillian offered me Night Owl on Radio City, which hadn't gone on the air yet. And I thought, well, they're all three-month contracts. They'll find me out at the end of the 3 months. So I better still be at home, because if I go to London, well, I won't be able to afford to do it, and then I'll be out of work in 3 months' time. So I thought, well, I'll stay at home in Liverpool. And I probably thought, well, I can get the accountant's job back when it all doesn't work out. So that was the one I took.
There was this huge camaraderie of people who worked in the first great wave of commercial radio, mostly because most of us were making it up as we went along.
Well, I mean, I was very lucky. I sent the demo tape. She said, well, the job's yours, but I advise you to turn it down, finish the accountancy and come back in a few years. And I said, thank you very much for the advice. I'm not going to take it. I'm going to take the job. So she said, well, you know, do you promise to go to night school to finish off the accountancy? And I did. And every time I see her now, she said, still not going to night school, are you? And I had to make a demo tape, though, actually live in the studio. And Graham Dean was there. He was the chief DJ, or whatever they called it. This is before the station went on air. I was absolutely bricking it, going into actually a real radio studio. And I could handle the technical side. It was all right. I was okay with that. But what am I going to do? So I went in and did my 6 records, and I didn't do very well. And the guy who followed me in the next audition was a guy called Jimmy James, whose name I used to see in the Liverpool Echo. So he was a club DJ there. I thought, oh, well, I've got no chance. You know, I'm a spotty 19-year-old, and his name's in the papers every week in adverts and stuff. So he'll get it. So I'm stuffed. And then later that day, a guy called Andrew rang me up and said, oh, really sorry, Rob, I threaded the tape wrong. Could you come and do it again? And I thought, oh, yes, that's all right. That's it. I think it was quite a good audition. And so, yeah, got the job, Night Owl, 2 till 6 in the middle of the night. We were the first live overnight show on the network outside of London, maybe even including London, I'm not sure. But it was 2 till 6. And Terry Bate, who some people will know, who ran BMS, the sales house, sat in with me all night long because he was so experienced from Canadian radio and everything. And about 6:15, I turned around and said, would you give me 15 minutes on my own so I can enjoy this? And he said, yeah, I could, and left. So I did enjoy the last 15 minutes. But it was great. And I was lucky because Graham Dean got the job at Capital to follow Kenny Everett on Breakfast. And so that left a gap at 9 o'clock in the morning. Rather mistakenly, I think they put me on that, which I did for nearly a year. But I was too young. I was almost at this stage, I'm 20 and I'm doing that show, and it was too young. I just didn't have enough experience. And so when David Maker took over the station, he said, oh, Rob, you know, you're doing great, but, you know, I think I don't want you to do that show. I want you to do a weekend show, a weekend breakfast. So that was the first thing that happened. But that was absolutely, it was the right thing to happen, because at the moment I was being told I was being moved on to weekend breakfast, a guy called Rob Eden was resigning as the commercial production manager upstairs. And I popped upstairs to see Jeff Moffat and said, would you give me a go at that job? And he said, all right. And that was great, because I was in a studio all week long, Monday to Friday, producing adverts and doing a show, two shows at the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So it was perfect. It was really good, really good experience.
Hi, this is Rob Jensen. Welcome to the American Top 20. At number 20, the Commodores dropped 6 places with Brick House, and sticking at number 19 this week, Brick.
The abiding memory is going in about 11 o'clock at night. This is before the station went on air, to do a dry run. And at this stage, not all the glass was in the windows of the studio. And I went to the front door, went in, there was a commissionaire, remember those at radio stations? And there was music drifting through the building, eerily through the building, because there was no glass in the studio windows, so it was wafting through the building, and it was Let It Grow, Eric Clapton from 461 Ocean Boulevard. It was so romantic, and a guy called John Henry and Bill Bingham were sort of doing a show together. And they had it up really loud, and I went in, and I'll never forget that, because I thought, well, this is it. I've joined a radio station. I'm on a radio station.
At 6 a.m. on Monday, October the 21st, Merseyside will have its very own 24-hour-a-day radio station. Radio City will be broadcasting 24 hours a day, 365 days a year from Liverpool to more than 2 million people in the greater Merseyside area.
It was lovely. Rocky old building in Stanley Street, which they'd made very, very nice. We had a great guy called Clive Burrows, who was a senior producer there. That's where we had some very good people. Nick Pollard was there, still in touch with Nick to this day. He was deputy head of news. But Clive Burrows was a real talent. He used to do a show on a Sunday morning called The 78 Spectacular. He was, gosh, an entertaining character with loads of stories. So I spent quite a lot of time with Clive, and his 78 Spectacular on a Sunday morning was just funny. Highly produced. In the end, I think I spent about half the week producing that 1 hour, as well as being head of music. But so much effort went into the 78 Spectacular. That was a great show. And then we had John Gorman was on the station. Alan Bleasdale was on the station. Names from around the Liverpool area would be, you know, hanging out around the station, which was a real buzz, because these were names and faces that I knew, and you were just sort of sitting down having a chat with them. It was brilliant. Records were in a box, and you picked out the next one. Or if you didn't like the next one, you'd go, oh, I'll take that one there. And so you basically played what you fancied from a playlist. And if you were really naughty, you'd actually nick some stuff from the library and play that as well. So there was very little music control in the way that we have it now, where you simply press next and selector or Zeta or whatever cues up the next song for you. So, you know, you'd be literally picking the next record out. And then whilst that record was playing, you'd be turning round, and there'd be this huge carousel of cartridges behind you. And you'd have to go, well, the next break has got 365 or 412. And you'd have to pull them all out. You'd have about 6, maybe even 9 carts you'd have to load up to go to the commercial break. So rather than pressing commercial break one button, you had to load and then unload all these carts, which was a challenge sometimes. 1, 9, 4. I was doing my show on In fact, I think I was doing a fill-in, funnily enough, during the week. That's right, I was doing a fill-in in the mid-morning slot. And I had a phone call. The guy on the phone here called Alan Keane. I said, oh, OK. So he passed it over and this guy said, hello, Rob, my name's Alan Keane. I'm the managing director of Radio Luxembourg. Can you talk? So I hello, Mr. Keane. Yes, hello. How can I? And he or somebody else had heard me on Radio City, and he said, we've got a vacancy. Peter Powell is leaving the station to go to Radio 1. Would you like to come and have a talk about it? And so I had I went down to London, 38 Hertford Street, had a chat with them, and seemed to go okay. That was on the Thursday. And on the Monday, it's weird how things kind of meant to be, aren't they? I was being interviewed by some school kids about being on Radio City. One of the kids, just in the course of this interview, one of them said, oh, you don't really sound like a Radio City jock. You sound more like a Radio Luxembourg jock. And the hackles on the back of my neck just, whoa, what's that about? Anyway, they disappeared. And I went out for lunch and said to Jeanette on the reception, said, any calls for me? No, sorry, Rob, nothing. Okay. Coming back from lunch, I looked at my digital watch going back into the offices at City, and the time was 2:08. And I said to Jeanette again, any calls? No. Oh, hang on. Somebody called Keane. Thanks. So I took the call. It was Alan Keane. And he said, Rob, we'd like you to join Radio Luxembourg. And of course, you know, hot flush. I'd be delighted to, Alan. Thank you very much indeed. Bob Stewart, it was, who spoke to me and organised things about when I would start and all the usual new job guff that you do.
Broadcasting on 208 metres in the medium wave, 1440 kilohertz AM, with a power of 1.3 million watts. This is the English service of Radio Luxembourg. Our programmes commence in...
When I resigned at Radio City, David Maker said, oh, Rob, you know, I think it's a mistake. Why would you want to go out there? At this stage at Radio City, this is 1977, I was earning £4,300 a year. And my starting salary at Luxembourg was £33,000. So no choice, really. Luxembourg, of course, had probably had its heyday by the time I got there. You know, I remember listening to Luxembourg 70, 71, 72, and this was 77. So it was kind of past its best then. That's probably unfair to a few people. But, you know, the days of Tony Prince and Paul Burnett, Kid Jensen, Noel Edmonds for a while, you know, they'd gone. So it wasn't, you know, at the top of its game by that stage. Of course, there was lots of opposition from commercial radio, quite apart from the BBC. There were a lot of commercial radio. It's very strange that there was a really close relationship between Radio 1 and Radio Luxembourg back then. Doreen Davis would regularly talk to us and Luxembourg, and they would share audience data, which was, you know, because just wouldn't happen now, would it? But mainly because Luxembourg probably wasn't a threat to Radio 1 and actually had proved a good recruitment ground for them. So I suppose that would be the reason that there was quite a close relationship.
Hello, that's me, and here's our top 10. I love the sound
of breaking down. It was interesting to, particularly if you were on later on Luxembourg, because we went on shortwave, so we would be on 208 medium wave across lots of Europe, but we'd be on FM in parts of Europe and then on shortwave as well. So you would get mail from New Zealand or New York or Australia and weird places. So that was quite a buzz. And in my first couple of years at Luxembourg, my mailbag, 2,000 letters a week. So, you know, that's how people communicated with radio stations in those days. And I not stupidly, I think I did the right thing. I tried to write back and send a photograph back to loads of them. I mean, I failed miserably, but I tried manfully to connect with them in some way. But it was huge. I mean, you know, if you were Radio 1, of course, you were getting another note on the 20,000 a week in those days. We then did take phone calls on Luxembourg. When we moved into a new studio, actually, before that you couldn't take phone calls, but then you could, and we gave a number out, and the calls would come from all over the shop. I mean, that was very interesting. But people were very passionate about Luxembourg, and one of the things we did a lot were, of course, gigs. We used to go, you know, I used to go back every weekend for a club, so I'd sort of do an hour on a Friday night, maybe an hour on a Saturday night, and that was, you know, that all added to the the savings as well, as it were. So it was, you know, it was good. And when you turn up at these clubs, people would know you. And in fact, I got a gig at, it was the top rank in Liverpool not long after I'd gone to Luxembourg. And I had a bit of press in Liverpool about going. And it was brilliant. It was a really good turnout, you know, and I felt very, very welcomed back.
Hey, how would you girls like to join me in a pair of Lopez jeans from Foster Menswear? No, don't get me wrong, they're so skin-tight and slim-fitting, there's only room for one. But straight up, did you know Foster Menswear sell great jeans for the chicks as well as the fellas? Heavyweight denim, Lopez jeans, just $9.95. Stylish Lopez cord jeans, also...
So you go out to Luxembourg with trepidation, obviously, thinking, gosh, have they made a mistake? Have they made a mistake here? Because you know, it's only me, you know, and this is going to be fantastic. And funnily enough, Luxembourg didn't take on just me in that recruitment drive. Two of us joined at the same time. It was myself and Mike Reed. I think I arrived for Mike. And I got to the airport and went on a Luxair flight, an old aeroplane, and got to Luxembourg. And Bob Stewart was there to meet me at the airport. Bob, now sadly no longer with us, greeted me with, "How you doing, kid? You're going to hate it here." Sorry? Yeah, you're going to hate it here. And it was very, very different. You know, life in Luxembourg is very, very different. But arriving at the Villa Louvigny in the middle of a park, in the middle of the city of Luxembourg, was awesome. It was big. And then you went in, and of course, to go to, and lots of people don't know that Radio Luxembourg was just a very small part of a big broadcast organisation called RTL. So you'd go in, big reception, and then to go to our studios, you'd have to walk through a television studio. Wow, this is good. And then you'd walk past a German radio studio and another German studio and a French studio and a Belgian studio. And then there's the English studio. So there were loads of studios and loads of broadcasting going on, none of which I expected to see. That, you know, it was a busy hub of broadcasting, and we were, you know, although, you know, in the UK it was quite famous, no one ever knew about all the other stuff. So the RTL German service was huge. Obviously the RTL French service even bigger, although they did most of their broadcasting from Paris, but half of the day or quarter of the day they broadcast from the Villa Louvigny. That was the big surprise, that it was so much bigger than I expected it to be. And there we were, we had our studio. And luckily, when I got there, they'd just gone self-op, because prior to, literally months before I joined, you'd have an engineer and you'd just have to wave your finger at him to start the record. And so you didn't touch a fader or anything. A couple of months before I got there, they'd just started self-op, which is what I loved. You know, that was one of the motivations for radio, was fingers on the buttons and the faders and making sound, you know, making a montage of sound with jingles and voice and records. That's what turned me on about radio, particularly. And I think I wouldn't have enjoyed it as much if it hadn't been self-op. I think I would have been disappointed. It was great. And you could look out of the window from our studio. No soundproofing. So you could, if it was a hot night, you'd open the window. You would open the window. And sometimes people would shout up from the park. The mics were so directional, you never heard that. But you could hear it when you moved away from the mic if you turned the speakers down. And people would shout up. And one of the people in my early years was Fergal Sharkey, because the Undertones were in town. And he said, "Oh, let us in, let us in." So they were a bit drunk. I let them in, but I thought, I better not do too much of an interview here because I'm going to get in trouble. But they were very funny. It wasn't completely free. Again, you had your box of records and you picked out the songs you wanted to play from that. But their view there was very much, get on the air, be great. If you're not great, hey, we'll be saying goodbye. So make sure they love you. And that was it, really. We also had records that we had to play in each hour because Luxembourg owned the publishing on them, or a company called Louvigny Marquis Music owned the publishing on those records. So certain records on the playlist each week would be published by the company. So they were paid for plugs. And also the Power Play, which on the top of the hour was a record we played every hour all week long. That was paid. Record companies paid for that to be played. So there were certain points in the hour where, you know, that record has to be played because it's you're being paid to play it. Or the company's being paid to play it, you know. So that was interesting. Rob Jones. I'd been at Luxembourg a month, and this is a rude story, so forgive me. And Tony Prince said, Rob, we'd like you to go and do a programme with Leif Garrett. Do you remember that song, I Was Made for Dancing? We'd like you to go and make a programme with Leif Garrett in Los Angeles next week. And I said, oh, but I was going home next week. He said, do you want me to send someone else? Oh, no, don't send anyone. I'll go. So rather than going home to Liverpool for my first visit home after joining, I got on a plane that went to Frankfurt and then Frankfurt to LA. And at LA, I was met by Leif Garrett and his management and a whole load of screaming fans. Bizarre. Anyway, we got in a limo and we went to the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, where I had a suite. And, you know, Pretty Woman was made at the Beverly Wilshire. And of course, I went to my room. The first thing I did was turn on the radio, and playing on the radio with Peg by Steely Dan, because that was a big song at the time. And we're talking, this is January 1978. I seen your picture. So I just consumed as much American radio as I possibly could, other than having to do the various things that I had to do. Anyway, they said, well, we're going to have dinner at El Camino's. We'll pick you up at 7. At 7 o'clock, there was a knock on my room door. And there was a vision in pink who said, hi, I'm Candy. I've come to take you to dinner. So you know what was expected, or they perhaps were expecting something. Anyway, we went to dinner. We went to see George Benson, by the way, at the Roxy. And then we went back to my hotel, because just arrived. I'd come on the plane, I hadn't been to sleep or anything. So Candy's in the limo, and we're all in the limo. Candy's getting out to come back with me to my room. You know, I am, 21, 22 at this stage? And she says, shall I come up? And I said, oh, do you know what? I'm really tired. And I really was tired. And so the face is all dropped. The face is all dropped. Oh, what's this? Because obviously she was a hooker and she had been laid on for me. And I turned her down. So everyone's face is dropped, especially Candy. So did that mean she didn't get paid or something? But I went to bed, had a very good sleep. And it was arranged that I was going to be picked up the next morning to go to Disneyland, because I'd never been to Disneyland. So the next morning, 10 o'clock, there was a knock on the door, opened the door, vision in pink, and the guy said, hi, I'm Dwayne. And so Dwayne was now my date for the day. And I think they thought, oh, did we get it wrong? You know, does he swing the other way? It's Dwayne taking me round Disneyland, which was lovely, which was fantastic. But I don't think I did any of the things they thought I might do or was expected to do. I then spent the next 2 days in the studio with Leif Garrett, watching him record some more stuff and making a half-hour program with him, which we then ran on Luxembourg when I got back. So that was quite an induction after just a month at Luxembourg.
All you have to do is drop me a line. It's Mike Reed, Night Owl, Radio Luxembourg, London W1. OK, your name and the name of the person or persons to whom you would wish to
well,
say
well, Mike and I guess we're a little bit competitive to begin with, because we joined at the same time. I think I got Peter Powell's show 7 to 9, and I think Mike wanted that. They gave Mike 1 to 3, and I don't know. I was a bit younger than Mike, so perhaps that's why they wanted me to have the teeny audience. And Mike was obviously a great musicologist and knew all about the music much more than I was, in all honesty. So we were a little bit competitive, but there was a time in the first year there where Mike and I were both going back for television shows. Mike had a TV show for Yorkshire TV called Pop Quiz.
Good evening. Welcome to Pop Quiz. Hey. While you're at home, try and get the better of our 6 celebrities here.
And I had a show for ITV, but produced out of Manchester for Granada, called Breakers.
Right now, Charles are going to play us out with Maybe Tomorrow. So for me, Rob Jones, bye-bye.
Mike was a good television performer. I was crap. But I got the job, very sadly, because Mark Boland had been in that car crash, and Mark was doing a quarter of the year on ITV, Tuesdays 4:20, when he died. And Muriel Young got in touch with me and said, will you come over and have a chat, darling? So I went over to Manchester. They did a little audition with me there and went back up to her office. And she said, have you got an equity card? I said, no. And she said, well, get one by Friday, love, and the job's yours. What? How the hell do I get an equity card now? Because that's what you needed in those days to be on the telly. So I did. Alan Keane was very helpful. He was very well connected. So I got my equity card and I got my show thank God there are no tapes of it, because I was awful. I'm the typical good face for radio, really. But it was an interesting lesson, and I made some very good contacts. David Liddiment was working there, and Steve Leahy, both working there, about the same age as me, a little bit older than me, at Granada, and both went on to sort of big careers there, and still stayed in touch with them over the years.
In those days, the record companies had record shows rather than Luxembourg playing all the records in one programme from the various companies. I was utterly brainwashed to EMI Records.
You may remember that Muriel Young did the 5 o'clock club with Ollie Beak and Wally Whiten on ITV, and she was an amazing character. And I hadn't realised until after I'd met her, that she'd been a presenter on Radio Luxembourg herself years before that, in the, I guess, early 60s. So she was quite predisposed to liking people who were in Luxembourg, I suppose. So maybe that's why I got the job. But she was gentle, friendly, very, very powerful. And she knew it, because she was head of, basically, they didn't have ITV's head of children's, but she was head of children's at Granada, which in essence was, you know, head of ITV children's. And she, in those days of the franchises owning different slots, Mew, as we called her, owned, you know, lots of airtime, and she filled lots of airtime for the network. She was powerful.
The music centre of Europe, Radio Luxembourg.
When Alan Keane left, we had a boss called Patrick Cox, whose father started ITN. Patrick was a very serious gentleman, but I got on with him very well. Some of the other people didn't get on with him quite so well, but he seemed to like me, and I liked him. And he said, we've got to do television. Radio is great, but for us to develop this English part of the business, the British part of the business, we need to get into satellite television. And he was, you know, quite ahead of his time. And so he said, I'd like you, having had a bit of experience at Granada, and Mike had left by this time, and Steve Wright had been and gone by that time as well. We didn't talk about Steve. Steve was a funny guy. Really enjoyed Steve. I am going to take credit. He won't deny this. I went to Los Angeles in 80 and met Rick Dees and taped Rick Dees massively, and actually was offered a job at KISS, but it was overnights, and it was less money than I earned at Luxembourg and everything. But I taped Dees, everything he did, the whole week, and lent the tapes to Steve, and so much of that stuff helped him develop what he ended up developing. And he did it better. He did it in his own way, which was the great thing about Steve, was that he would take something and then develop it and make it a Steve Wright thing. So he never copied anyone. He'd take the idea, maybe, or the concept, and then, you know, make it his own.
Love it, love it, love it. That's Randy Van Warmer, and this is Rick Dees in the morning. And just when I needed you most, zip, there you go. It is now 9 minutes after 6 o'clock. And I tell you what we have. We have some Dees discount questions.
Luxembourg wasn't the happiest, even though it was a great job. It was brilliant. But I was always striving to get back to Blighty. You know, you always want to get back to Blighty. I knew that living in Luxembourg was not going to be forever for me. So I can't say I was completely happy, because I really wanted to go to Radio 1. I desperately wanted to go to Radio 1, and nearly did. My agent, Joe Gannett, tell you the saddest moment in my whole career was when Joe had said, be around near a phone all day, darling, because you're going to be hearing from Radio 1 today. Doreen will be ringing you. Great, this is it, I've got the job. No phone call, nothing. Walked into the office at Luxembourg, 5 o'clock in the evening, and Steve Wright's just putting the phone down. Jonesy, your chum's going to Radio 1. And I can't tell you that I didn't go home and cry. So that was the saddest moment, without a doubt. I mean, listen, they picked the right guy, no question there. But that was the lowest point, it really was. Steve and I always say, don't look back, look forward. Because we always get invited to these Luxembourg reunions and stuff like that. And I don't go, and Steve doesn't go, because you look forward, you don't look back.
This is Rob Jones with Radio Luxembourg, Nightline News at midnight. The British Water Council...
Patrick wanted us to get into television, so I developed a late-night English-speaking programme called BOMP, Before Our Next Programme, B-O-N-P, Before Our Next Programme, which utilised all the jocks that were there, and music videos, and we did sketches. And some of it was completely puerile and dreadful, and some of it was inspired and quite clever. Not my stuff, but other people. And then MTV started not long after that. And there was a big meeting at RTL about MTV. And this was, I was the only English person there. There were Germans there and French there and whatever. And they asked me to tell them about what I knew about MTV, which I knew a little bit, but not much.
We all are so excited about this new concept in TV. We'll be doing for TV what FM did for radio.
And in this meeting, we collectively came up with an idea called Clip Connection. And RTL television only went on the air at 5 o'clock in the evening, you know, then go off at, you know, whatever time it went off. So they said, would you run this, Rob? And so I came up with a concept where the German service, the French service and the English service would each produce a series of 15-minute blocks. And so you couldn't talk for more than 10 seconds. You'd speak in your indigenous language, so in French and German and English, and you'd only do 3 links and 3 videos. And you'd pick them yourself. And, you know, that was quite creative for the guys concerned and the women concerned. I then had this bank of 15-minute programmes, which I've then built into a whole day's schedule of music television, if you like. It absolutely worked a dream. I mean, they sold out all the advertising just like that because there hadn't been any telly in the day in the middle of Europe. It really went great. And not long after that, Patrick left Luxembourg to become managing director of Sky Channel. And he'd been there a year and then rang me up and said, do you want to come and join me? And that was what I did. Maurice Fass, who was the managing director at the time, wouldn't talk to me from the day I resigned to the day I left, just 3 months. But I felt it was the right career move for me. And so left and went to Sky Channel, which by the time I got there had been going about 6 months. So at Sky Channel, I was head of music production. That meant 9 hours of original music television programmes. And we had 4 jocks actually, Tony Blackburn, Gary Davis and Pat Sharp. And they were the 3 VJs. And then there was a girl called Linda de Mol, who was a Dutch presenter, a sister of John de Mol, who had a bit of success in the television world.
Hi there, boys and girls. Oh, hello, Linda speaking.
A very good Dutch presenter. She was only young at the time, but she was very good. So those were our three. And I think I brought in a girl called, that's right, I brought in another girl called Amanda Reddington. And so some of those programmes were actually live. And we used to do them in a studio in Whitfield Street in the West End. It was great. I nicked lots of radio ideas for that, including one programme which we did live on a Friday. Gary Davis was the host, and we called it Ronnie the Runner. And it was a 45-minute programme where people could phone in, as they did from all over Europe, and say, oh, I'd like that video by Heart, please. And Gary would then set Ronnie the Runner on his run to the video library. Cameras would follow him, he'd pull out the video, then take it to the VT room, stick it in the machine and play it. And we'd give him a minute to do that. And of course, it was all set up. So we'd have little obstacles in his way in the corridor and pyro flash that went off. And it was very funny, I have to say. It was the record race. It was radio's record race, but just transferred to television.
Ronnie the Runner, on your marks, get set, go! He has 60 seconds in which to go and find ZZ Top and sharp-dressed man. He's running out of the studio into the corridor. What's Noddy Holder and Jimmy Lee doing there?
Working for the Murdoch empire, which it was quite challenging and different to anywhere I'd worked before. I actually didn't like it. There were some good bits, like, you know, like Ronnie the Runner and some things that we did. But I didn't really like it very much because quite aggressive. And, you know, that's why he's been so successful. But we used to have management meetings every Monday morning. The goalposts seemed to move every week. So you'd spent the last week thinking, we'll do that. I'll work towards that. Oh, no, we're not doing that anymore. Oh, we're going to do this. It was strange. I mean, it was just not the place for me, in all honesty. I had a great boss, Gary Davey. Gary was an Australian. Never forget one Monday morning, he got 3 of us management team in his room and played us a tape. He said, what do you think of this, guys? And it was WrestleMania. We'll put it on the air from next week. Because he said, you know, you're English, white, middle-class blokes, if you'd have liked it, I'd been really worried about that. So yeah, that he was genius. Gary Davey was the guy who commissioned Chernobyl. Funny, I had a meeting with him just recently, and he commissioned Chernobyl. Brave move, but a brilliant move. Anyway, I wasn't wild about working with them, and I'd mentioned this to a PR lady. Julian Mounter was running a service called Music Box, which was a rival to us at Sky. He invited me over for a chat, and a few months went by, and somebody else rang me up. and said, music box is being taken over. And there's a guy who'd like to have a chat with you. Could you meet him in this restaurant in Notting Hill? So I turned up at this restaurant, not knowing who I was going to meet. And at the table, it was Richard Branson and a lawyer. And they said, we've just bought Music Box. You're doing a decent job with Sky Tracks on Sky. Would you like to come and do it for us? And I said, you're like a knight in shining armour. I'd love to come and do it. So I did. I got into a lot of trouble with Sky. There were lawsuits and all sorts of stuff. They threatened to sue me for breaking my contract and all sorts. It was a bit worrying, but it was the right decision. That was definitely the place for me to work. Music Box was much more me, in truth.
Now, stay with the action around the clock as the mighty Music Box rocks 24 hours a day. From dawn till dusk and beyond the twilight zone, Europe's most music is right there whenever you need it.
Richard Branson, a maverick, as they say. David Campbell, who you'll know, was working with me there at the same time. We'd have regular meetings with Richard, and it was seat of the pants. But there were strange decisions made at certain times when we'd leave the meeting and go, why have they done that? And what Richard was very good at was keeping things very close to his chest, because we were operating on a knife edge at one stage. It's in Richard's book, so I'm not breaking any confidences here, but we're operating on a knife edge. There was a time when he wasn't sure he'd be able to pay any of the salaries and all that sort of stuff, and he had to sell a big portion of the airline to keep the whole thing going at one stage. The airline, I thought he'd be a big music man, you know, be really into the music. No, he wasn't at all. He was really into the airline. He loved that airline. And that came first. I mean, he was good about the Music Box stuff we were doing, and he was always very helpful and everything. But his brother-in-law, Robert Devereux, was actually sort of my line manager, not actually Richard.
Beaming live from the Starship Voyager, 23,000 miles above the planet Earth. This is the Superstation.
The Superstation was a project that Richard gave to David Campbell and I to go and look at running a Europe-wide radio station. And so David and I had a wonderful 3 months travelling around Europe, talking to Canale Centocinque in Italy, various stations, NRJ in France, Jean-Paul Baudecroux. We had long meetings with him. And the idea was that we would put together a radio station and it would be pan-European. And we also commissioned research to find out what about the advertising for this as well. And a guy called Tony Logie did all that research on the advertising front, trying to put together a schedule and a cooperation between these three big markets, possibly four big markets. And it was all going quite well, but we talked about the programmes and how it was going to work and all that sort of stuff. And then the French, in only the way the French can do, and, you know, I love the French and I go to France and speak French, they said, but of course it will be in French. No, it's going to be in English. And the Germans have said, it's got to be in English. The Italians have said, well, it's English, obviously. At the time, Phil Collins was big. Phil Collins doesn't speak French. Phil Collins speaks English. Sorry, Phil Collins, if you do speak French. So it sort of started falling apart. And then the research came in from Logie that said it's going to be very difficult to get advertising revenue pan-European because the markets are all different. And we all know the reasons for that now. So we had a Friday breakfast with Richard, David and I. And we said, don't think it's actually going to work. Really sorry. And I thought he'd be cross, sort of thing, but he wasn't. He said, oh, okay. Think of something else. Let's meet again on Monday. So, oh, okay. So over the weekend, I think I'd had a chat with Ralph Bernard, and this was about most stations had an AM and an FM frequency. And the radio authority at the time was saying, well, actually, we think you should put additional programming on that other frequency. And so you have two services and increased choice for listeners. Very good idea. So I said, well, why don't we do a sustaining service? Because they won't all be able to afford to do programming all the time on two stations suddenly from one. So I suggested to Richard, and he said, oh, great idea, love it, makes sense to me. Well, go and find some investors. So the investors ended up being Richard Findlay at Radio 4th, Ron Coles, Trent. Oh, Hallam was involved, that's right, a very nice chap whose name I forget now. They invested, and Ralph Bernard invested. So Virgin kept 60%, as they normally do, and the other 40% was divided between those stations. And they all said, well, we'll take it from 10 night through till 6 the following morning. But they said, it's got to be good. It's got to be good. And we wanted it to be good. And we'd made a pretty good demo tape of who we were going to have on it. At the start, we were on 18 stations, and the peak we got up to, I think it was 26 or 27 stations. So, it was, you know, that, and that as a proportion of the number of stations about at the time was pretty good. And one of the hot names at the time, because he had a show called The Last Resort, was Jonathan Ross. So I got onto Jonathan and he said, yeah, it'd be great to do. Asked for a lot of money, which we gave him. Then Ralph rang me and said, speak to Johnny Walker. Johnny'd be brilliant for this. So I spoke to Johnny. Johnny came on board.
Track from the brand new album from Big Audio Dynamite, the LP called Tighten Up Volume 88. And we're going to rock non-stop all night long.
Bob Harris came on board. I thought Ruby Wax would be good. So I got Ruby Wax in. She did some of the funniest programming ever. We used to get quite a few Radio Authority complaints about her. And Paul Brown used to ring me up and say, oh, Ruby's done this again last night. And I said, yeah. He said, well, just explain what she's done. He said, you'd know, wouldn't you, that it's after 9 o'clock, after the watershed, it's going to be not for children and adults. I said, exactly. He said, fine. Okay. Next. So Paul was very supportive, very good, but wanted it justified. And, you know, because she'd tell funny stories, which were quite rude.
Pretty titillating here. Hello? Hi, I'm sorry to disturb you at home at this hour. Hello?
Hello, yeah.
Hi. My name is Ruby Wax, and I'm on the radio tonight.
So that was the lineup. I got Steve Davis, the snooker player, to do a programme, which was funny. Steve Interesting Davis, who was always on Spitting Image at the time. Diana Luke, Canadian. Great voice. Very difficult to manage sometimes. And so she did the later hours till 6 in the morning.
Good morning, my darlings. Have you been doing some serious moon bathing? Because if you looked at that moon, it is beautiful. I want to hear about it a little bit later on.
And it did well. And I remember Stuart from Hereward ringing up after the first Rajar saying, I've got a problem because we've got a bigger audience at 10 o'clock than we have at breakfast time. And he said, I don't know how to deal with this. Well, so we had, you know, Jonathan Ross on, Johnny Walker, so big names. Transworld eventually came in. They were slow coming in. And Mike Briscoe was the programme director there, and he wasn't sure about taking it. And then I think he got a little bit of pressure from somebody to take it, so they did take it. But Mike was always my biggest challenge for what everyone had done and said and played the night before he would be on. But Mike actually led me to hire somebody who was very, very good. He had a young chap called Chris Evans on the air at Piccadilly at the time, and Mike sacked him for talking about putting a cat under the grill or something. And Andy Bird, who worked for me at Music Box, then at the Superstation, said, this guy's great, you've got to bring him in. So we brought Chris in as a producer, and he produced Jonathan Ross, and they, of course, got on like a house on fire. And Chris, so good with ideas. I remember we'd have brainstorms every week and we'd all sit around trying to think of clever ideas. And then Chris would come up with that really simple thing. Chris Evans, his genius was just thinking up the simple and just doing that. Just do that. Oh, yeah, it works. It did need execution. And then no one, I guess, executed it better than Chris. And then Chris left and went off to Radio London because they'd offered him a job on the air. And it's in his book. I'd said, no, you're a great producer. You won't make a presenter. Duh. Andy Bird, I should say, though, in passing, was the real genius of all that team. Andy being good at Music Box. He was very good at Radio or the Superstation. And he then went on to various other things. Right now, Andy is, I think he's number two in Disney worldwide. So it did all right. But for ad revenue, it didn't do all right. And BMS was selling it. I'd asked Terry and BMS to sell it. I don't know why it did. They didn't sell it. We had some adverts, but it wasn't enough. So we got to the point where we weren't getting advertising revenue. So it was costing money. And Charles Leveson, the late Charles Leveson, who was the lawyer that had met me that first time with Richard, said, look, you know, I think we need to get out of this. Do you think you can get someone to buy our share? And so I spent the next weeks talking to the various stations about whether they'd like to pick up Virgin's share. Out of the blue, at the very last minute, Owen Oyston and Transworld picked up Virgin Share. They bought Virgin Share. At that point, there wasn't really a role for me. And so I stayed with Virgin for a while, and we had the early talks about Virgin Radio, the Virgin Radio that people know now. But you know, around that time, a guy called Alan Hardy from Yorkshire Television rang me up and said, do you think you might be available to help us? And so that was just a natural thing, starting my own consultancy. And I was very, very lucky. I had a call from a guy called Peter Gilardi, who was the new managing director of a new radio station that was going to come on the air called Jazz FM. And so I went to see them, and I was Jazz FM's first programme consultant before it went on the air. Helped Ron Onions, lovely Ron Onions, recruit the staff, including Dinah Luke, who ended up doing Breakfast, and Helen Mayhew, who did Dinner Jazz. I found her tape. She sent her tape in from Radio Kent, I think it was. And Ron and I sat and listened to it one morning and said, this girl's great, isn't she great? Helen was probably one of the first signings. She was an obvious signing. And then Dave Lee, who was a 24% shareholder in the radio station, and Dave wrote and produced Sophia Loren and Peter Sellers' Goodness Gracious Me.
Oh, Doctor, I'm in trouble.
And Dave was a very big character and said, oh, no, we can't have Star Award. I heard her on the World Service 4 years ago. She mispronounced Dizzy Gillespie's name. I couldn't possibly have her on the station. And it wasn't Dizzy Gillespie's name, but some name that she'd mispronounced. And he was ready to put it to a board vote not to have her. So I said, well, here's another girl. She's called Diana Luke. Dave, he met her for 10 minutes and then forgot about her. He said to me, oh, no, totally unsuitable. So I got Diana to do the station sales tape. In the board meeting when they were playing the sales tape, Dave said, that's the voice we need at breakfast. That's the one. So I said, do you think so? He said, let's sign her up. And, of course, it was Diana Luke. So she got the job in the end. That's radio all over, or isn't it? Coincidences, things like that.
Well, it certainly is very early in the morning, and I haven't got the blues because we are a brand new start.
Jazz FM was the first of the new wave of, if you like, specialist radio stations. Most stations up to that point had either been a la LBC talk, or there'd been music and top 40 music. There'd been no specialist music at all. And jazz got their license on the basis that they were going to play jazz. Nice idea, but probably flawed in the sense of people don't know what jazz is. You know, what is jazz to you? Jazz is Dizzy Gillespie to some people, but it's Akapilk to others. And having that name jazz either turned you right on and then you'd turn the station on and it wouldn't be the jazz you were hoping for, or turned you right off in the first place. I don't like jazz, never tried it. So it was problematic, but well funded. It was very well funded, but problematic. And against the backdrop of the other stations, well, I don't think any of the stations were the least bit worried about it.
There is a lot of partying going on here at Jazz FM. The champagne is flowing. I'm telling you, they're in there. They're all toasting. We are going to have a great day.
Those various consultancies I had with Yorkshire Television and with the others, with Ralph, and I also had one with Essex as well, and Jazz and whatever. At Jazz, I met a lady called Deanna Hallett. We got on very well. She was consulting jazz at the same time. And we were just talking about what we were doing with our futures and all this sort of stuff. And she said, come and have lunch with Jonathan Rent. To cut a long story short, decided, well, why don't we start a programme consultancy? So Deanna was research, as everyone knows. Jonty at the time was doing marketing consultancy for various stations, and I was doing programme consultancy. So it was a virtuous triangle, if you like. That was where USP started. We named that company USP. That went fine for a long time. So this was 1990 now we're talking about. I loved working with Deanna and Jonty. They were great fun to work with. One of the things I'd done for the stations was find prizes to give away. So I'd contact an airline, and so that Jonty's marketing campaign would have something, win a holiday to America on the side of the bus, I'd find the airline and the holiday in America, and the radio station would run that competition on the air. And that worked really well and did it for the stations. And at that point, I was being paid by the stations. Then a couple of the airlines and the destinations said, that was great, but could you do this for us? And we'd like to do this in Italy and Germany, if that's possible as well. I said, yeah, sure, I can do that. So I, rather than being paid by the station, I would go to the stations in Germany, Italy or wherever, and Britain still, and say, would you like to do a competition to win tickets to the opening act of the Rolling Stones in Washington, D.C.? and promotions were in their infancy, if you like, and they were just very happy to have the prize. So they give the promotion for the airline and the destination and run the competition. And then Terry Bate rang me up. The side of BMS, there was a company called Radio Projects, and Terry wanted to get out of that. And so Jonathan Arendt and I decided we wouldn't buy it, but we'd just buy the assets of the company. And so Radio Projects became part of USP, and it was then USP Radio Projects. And the company morphed into being really a promotions agency, more than a program consultancy. At one stage, we were the biggest purchaser of promotions on Capital of anyone. We did all Cadbury's work. We did a lot of work for Mars, amazingly. It was good. But then the media agencies decided, at that point, they didn't want to have anything to do with promotions. Far too much hassle, too much work. But the media agencies were being squeezed on their margin on spot advertising. And so they wanted to get every bit of inventory they could. And we had a challenge with Saatchi's for the Cadbury business on promotions. And in year one, we won it. And at the year two, we suddenly found out, no, we'd lost it because Saatchi's had rolled it into their overall contract with Cadbury's. That was the point where I thought, oh, there could be, I can see the end in sight for promotions, or it's going to be much more difficult. And so I thought, well, let's get back to maybe making programmes. And we pitched and won the Talk Radio Breakfast Show. And actually, just before we did that, we had been producing Jazz's Breakfast Show as an independent production with Tim Smith. And so we were doing that. And then Paul Robinson was running Talk Radio. And he said, would you be interested to pitch for the breakfast show? And so we pitched Kirsty Young for the breakfast show, made a great pilot, got Robin Cook involved in the pilot, would you believe? That's what won it. Paul Robinson said, oh, as soon as we heard Robin Cook, you got Robin Cook for the pilot. We thought, well, they can do it. We won that and did that for 2 years until Kelvin took over. And that is a whole other story, because Kelvin... I'd helped Kelvin with something in radio before that. And I rang him up and said, you're not going to like this, are you? You're going to want to do something different. No, no, it's great, man. It's great. It's fine. You know, we'll stick with it. And I even rang him up the day before he went in. I said, are you sure about this, dude? No, no, man, it's great. It's no problem at all. I'll get in touch with you. 2 days into his tenure at Talk, Kelvin rings me up and said, well, it's a pile of shit, isn't it? It's just shit. I said, no, 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 it's not. It's not shit at all. It's exactly what Paul Robinson briefed us to do. Ah, shit, you must be embarrassed with it. I said, not in the least bit embarrassed with it, because it's absolutely on brief. Now, have you got another brief? Well, and of course, he was rude about Kirsty and everything. And so he said, oh, you got, I need to see you. So I said, okay, well, come in now. I said, no, no, I'll see you next week. And I thought, I'm not going in at your beck and call. I'll make you wait a week. And so he made me wait in reception when I went in. And I'd taken legal advice from Shillings, and he was really shitty with me for, and we knew each other, but he was really shitty with me for 15 minutes or so. And they said, well, how are we going to sort this out? We don't need to take this to lawyers, do we? I said, well, I think we probably do, actually, because we've still got, you know, 18 months of the contract to go, unless you want to make me an offer. No, no, you'll get creamed. He said, who are your solicitors? I said, well, Shillings. He left the room, came back and paid off the next 18 months of the contract like that. Easy.
Hi, I'm David Hamilton. Please join me every day at 10 a.m. on the wireless from Age UK. We've got a terrific show for
We'd been working with a company called Image Sound, who do in-store radio, and we've been doing all the spoken word content for a few of their contracts, including Superdrug and this, that and the other. And they were pitching Age UK to do in-store for Age UK. So they said, could you come along to this meeting? Went along to the meeting, managing director, marketing director, and we all got on very well. And then, a bit naughtily, the MD and the marketing director got in touch with me directly afterwards and said, can you come and talk to us again? Tom Wright, the CEO of Age UK, had been involved in Saga Radio. He was on the board of Saga Radio. And he said, I think we should do our own radio station and we should do it on DAB. So I made him a proposal. They were on the London DAB and the Yorkshire DAB initially, and obviously online. There were two points to doing that. One was to provide entertainment for the shops. The most important part was to get a voice in London, because we had a programme on in the evening at 6 o'clock with Martin Lewis, or should say Sir Martin Lewis, called Agenda. And each evening they would address issues of later life, and we'd invite MPs in. Whereas it made a nice programme sometimes, it was much more used to Age UK as a vehicle to lobby some MPs. So they'd come in, do the programme, they'd have a nice cup of tea or a sherry or something like that, and they would they'd be able to talk to these MPs. I thought that was their reason for wanting to do this, be heard in Westminster. So we ran that for 5 years. At best, the radar it had was 60,000 a week. That was its reach, was 60,000. Its worst was about 11. And I don't think either of those figures was correct because it was such a small sample size. I think it was somewhere in the middle, probably. Yeah, eventually they couldn't afford to do it anymore because it had David Hamilton on it, had Graham Dean on it, Sir Martin was on it. And so they said, we need to just reduce it so it's just for in-store. So we reduced it for in-store, just an online service. But watch this space. Something else may happen with that soon.
That's it, a USP content production. I'll see you soon. Thanks for watching.
We had a couple of offers for the company. There was an offer on the table that my partner, my business partner, said, OK, we'll accept this one. He turned everything down up to that point. We were 60-40, with me having 60. There was one, though, that was quite good for me, but it wasn't brilliant for him. And so initially he said no, and then he said, you know what, OK, let's take it. So 5 to 12 were about to sign this deal, and he changed his mind and said, tell you what, I'll buy it. So he bought control. I said I'd stay on until we found out if we'd retained the Formula One contract or not. And then when we didn't, I left. And the company went into receivership early in 2019, by which time I'd gone. But I was relieved because it was very tough at the end. The whole negotiation with him was difficult. He didn't want to run the company the way that I wanted to run it. And so it was the right thing to finish. But I don't think he thought that quite so many clients would leave when I'd left. So right now, I have a small company called Ultimate Sound and Vision. We call it a content consultancy. It works, would you believe, for Age UK. It works for Tesco's and Dunnhumby, and that's about in-store radio. For British Airways, we work for Children with Cancer UK, an important one for us, and another charity, Marie Curie. And I'm not sure if we won it or not, but we've certainly been nominated for the best branded podcast for On the Marie Curie Couch. That's a really nice podcast where a celebrity will talk to a counsellor, a genuine Marie Curie counsellor, about someone in their life who's passed away. And it sounds morbid, but it isn't. It's often joyful, and it's lovely to be involved in doing it.
Hugh, welcome to the Marie Curie Couch. Can I ask if you've had a significant death in your life? I know you're happy to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, the most significant death, I suppose, was my mother's death, which was in 2001.
You know, being involved with these charities is good. I like the charity sector, and I've seen how they run and how they are run. And I do think that I could bring something that I've learned during my life to the charity sector in terms of running things, particularly, I guess, in the fundraising area. You know, people say to me, oh, you're a typical salesman or a good salesman, one of the two. I am a salesman. From being on the air, you're selling yourself, to selling a program or selling a concept. So I'm a salesman. And I think there are things I could do in the charity sector to help them raise money, which is right now very, very, very difficult and very, very important. I think it's a great shame radio isn't serving a local audience anymore. And there are obvious good commercial reasons for that. And I think it's a great shame that people in the older demographic, 60 plus, are not being served particularly well with radio at the moment. I think that will be addressed, I'm sure. Mary Portas was interviewed recently about post-COVID retail. And she said, I think we're going to get really local. I think the big malls are going to disappear. People are going to want to stay local and be local, but that does mean that local will have to super serve that community, will have to offer a really good service and exclusive products that they can't get online, or they'll need to go and touch and feel and look at. And I hope that's the same for radio. I hope maybe it isn't linear radio, but local audio could become important. Could have been nicer to some people. Could have been nicer. You know, I was ambitious. So I was, you know, I could be quite difficult, I guess, sometimes. So I suppose I could have been a nicer person at times. But with age, I think I've learnt a lot with age. It's a good thing. I don't mind being the age I am. Which is early 60s, by the way, just before you ask. I'd like to be remembered as a friend to the people that are important to me. And I think that's it.
Rob Jones. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd. Thank you very much indeed for the hugely encouraging remarks about this series. I've written a book, actually, which you might like, called Radio Moments, looking back at the last 50 years very personally through my own eyes. That's called Radio Moments, available in paperback or ebook.